hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of National Bugle Radio. And we are privileged to have back with us Reverend Mark Dankoff from San Antonio. Reverend Dankoff, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Patrick, and you and everyone else that knows me through the airwaves is fully free to call me Mark. That's Mark. The way I've been known in political and radio circles for many years. I don't mind being referred to as a pastor, of course, a Lutheran pastor when that comes up, but Mark is absolutely fine.
Right, and I have you here today not for your religious views, but because yes. You are a very accomplished commentator on international affairs, and this is really what I want to get to. And not just international affairs, on world, national affairs and everything, but you've been on Press TV a lot, Russia Today, all sorts of other outlets, international outlets, because you're recognized as an authority, and you do very good research on a variety of issues, but I want to talk about international issues today because there's been so much going on in the United States domestically. Of course, you have the election, you have the Black Lives Matter riots, you've got all sorts of things going on domestically. And of course, with the election, you've got all these distractions. The media wants to all of a sudden bring up the birther issue or something, anything to distract from what's really going on. But there's so much going on internationally that's just not getting into the news cycle. And as we were talking before the show, the prospects of Hillary Clinton winning and then doubling down on this craziness that's going on with saber-rattling with Russia, and it's really scary. And I think people need to be updated on what's going on internationally with Syria, with Ukraine, with the saber-rattling with Russia. That we need to focus on that. You're free to bring in any other news that you want to, but that's what I want to start with. So before we started, over the past couple of days, you sent me a number of articles that you thought were relevant dealing with Syria and Ukraine. So perhaps you could introduce the articles or just give your take on recent developments in our international relations.
Well, let me make reference just in general terms to some of these sources. I found it very striking, by the way. I listened, Patrick, to the 40-minute interview that you sent me of Dr. Stephen F. Cohen of both New York University and Princeton who was on the John Batchelor show several days ago. And it's fascinating to hear Dr. Cohen's take on Syria and Ukraine and Russia. There is some overlap with some of the things that you or I would say and certainly believe on this subject. And when we look at the whole issue of what Dr. Cohen did say, it's apparent to me that when you're listening to him, or when you're listening to some of the things that we would be talking about in this network, or some of the things that people like me, I'm certainly far from the only one, are saying on Press Television Iran and some of these other international outlets, we're saying them not only because we believe them to be true and we try to present qualitative and quantitative evidence on all of this, but there is a frightening complicity of the American news media. I believe it is a deliberate complicity on the part of the six major media consortiums that control what 98% of the American public might happen to watch or might happen to read for 5 minutes in regard to any of these political issues, but especially in foreign policy. And to me, that's especially frightening in the context of what you're talking about when it comes to Syria, when it comes to Ukraine, when it comes to these utterly irresponsible policies that the United States government is presently pursuing vis-a-vis Putin's Russia, that for the media not to be talking about it is absolutely breathtaking. And what's particularly breathtaking, and Dr. Cohen made reference to this in his interview that you sent to me, which I listened to in its entirety. Dr. Cohen no longer takes at face value anything that the United States government says on any of these topics. He is constantly checking sources, seeking to confirm and to verify anything that is said. Because when we start getting into this whole area of foreign policy and these wars in the Middle East and what's going on in Ukraine, what's going on in Eastern Europe, NATO, and so forth, the mainstream American media coverage of this ranges from silence to absolute spinning of false information and disinformation.
And I think it's important to add that when he was saying that he doesn't believe or take at face value any American government sources, maybe this is more because I listen to him on a weekly basis. He doesn't take anything at face value that the media says, and he particularly calls out the New York Times and Washington Post.
As he did in this interview that I listened to, and when one goes back and listens to those 40 minutes with Dr. Cohen recently on the John Batchelor show, he references a number of areas that involved the New York Times principally and the Washington Post. Secondarily, the Wall Street Journal was a third one cited, where it is quite obvious that there are things that they are reporting that are blatantly false or that are spun a certain way. One example of this, which may lead directly into what you wanted to discuss with these recent developments with these incidents in Syria, involves something that Dr. Cohen mentioned that happened in the New York Times on the 15th of September, where they referenced Ashton Carter, our defense secretary, as a source for what essentially proves to be, and it's right in the New York Times, the Department of Defense and Pentagon officials consulted by the New York Times refused to officially confirm their support for the ceasefire that Secretary of State John Kerry, with the full support of President Obama, negotiated with Lavrov in Syria. And the thing that is absolutely, again, breathtaking about this is it says everything in the world about what I will argue on this show is a much larger picture of subversion and infiltration of our foreign policy teams and our news media and our national security elements on behalf of the people that I argue, and Dr. Cohen does not address this part of it, that I argue are largely behind these interventions and that are largely behind the falsely spinning of what's going on over there, especially with these most recent events, both involving the illegitimate and illegal American Air Force airstrikes in Syria near Deir al-Zor, I believe is the name of the location, that killed at least 62 Syrian government troops that were opposing ISIS, that were opposing these Sunni Wahhabic extremists.
And before you continue, on Dr. Duke's show, I've often brought up Professor Cohen, his interviews. And I do this in part because, you know, he's somebody who, however you want to pigeonhole yourself or pigeonhole me with a label, he's not that label, right? He's somebody from a different background, a different perspective, and somebody who, in terms of what you would think of as mainstream credentials, you know, a full professor at Princeton, he's somebody who is on first-name basis with most of the leaders of Russia. You know, he's been around for so long. He was the CBS News consultant that was on TV all the time during the 80s when you had all of the upheaval in the Soviet Union. He was their go-to guy. So he's somebody with a huge amount of what should be credibility. Now, of course, the reason he's not on TV much anymore is because he actually got everything right. And he's, you know, he's left that. The rest of the establishment has been pursuing these crazy policies. And so I'd like to reference him, not because he's one of us, so to speak, but because the fact that he is, you know, has got such great credentials as an establishment person, and, you know, we're, you know, he's from the establishment side, but the fact that he says the same things that we do on so many issues, it really, I think it validates our position.
No question. Yeah. Absolutely no question about it. And this dovetails to the point I used to make in my old radio show on the Republic Broadcasting Network, which is a network that appeals to these American populist right and constitutionalist right types that listen to those shows and support that network, and that's fine. That happens to dovetail with my own political background, and I'm not ashamed of that. However, having said it, I always used to say in my RBN shows that consulting people like Cohen, I didn't mention him specifically, but I had in mind people like Stephen Cohen, consulting these kinds of people and looking at the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal and evaluating what they're saying and who is saying what is an invaluable regular exercise that we should avail ourselves of, because the mere fact that it's not in the American Free Press, the mere fact that we are reading something that is largely not something written by Pat Buchanan, who I love, does not necessarily invalidate it. And sometimes when we read mainstream sources, like obviously Dr. Stephen Cohen,
who's practically exiled from the mainstream, but that's his origin, though.
That's his origin, and he is clearly with not necessarily quite the same perspective by any means that you or I would share, or Duke or Buchanan or any of these other fine folks. He nonetheless is an intellect of first-rate capability. He's a gifted man. I think he's fair. His analysis is incredibly impressive in so many areas when I listen to these shows that you send me. And the long and the short of it is, Dr. Stephen F. Cohen, a lot of his very fine analysis coming not necessarily from our end of the political spectrum, but because he is agreeing with us in so many things as a person with incredible education and background and connections and experience for years in these matters. We need to be constantly in touch with his work and the work of other people that we don't necessarily always agree with, and they wouldn't necessarily endorse some of what we say and do, who in larger scope are agreeing with us. Another classic example is people like John Pilger, the Australian film critic, and Robert Perry, the longtime Newsweek correspondent who was very much involved in covering the Iran-Contra affair at the time it was going on. We run into others like Eric Margolis of the Toronto Sun, whose column I try to read all the time. These are folks who are not necessarily with us on some issues. And yet the thing that's fascinating is to see the extent to which those sources are saying that Hillary Clinton is the most dangerous candidate in this presidential race in terms of the potential to get a third world war ignited.
That's right. So I just want to say that I have it on very good authority that Dr. Cohen has received a fair amount of flack over the praise that he has gotten from us on the David Duke Show. But
they're listening to us.
Yeah, they are listening
on that show.
Yes, it's being monitored, that's for sure. Hillary Clinton quoted the David Duke Show in her big speech on the alt-right. But before I had interrupted you, you were just talking about the attack in Syria, the U.S. attack on the Syrian military. And I want you to continue with what you had been saying.
Well, when we evaluate, first of all, this American Air Force strike on the Syrian Arab Army positions, I think it's absolutely noteworthy that Stephen Cohen himself said that he did believe the U.S. Air Force's story that this attack was an accident. And when one evaluates the totality of Dr. Cohen's comments in this 40-minute interview that you sent me from the John Batchelor Show, he's saying the same things that I've been saying and a number of others have been saying since this thing happened, that this was deliberate, it was not a mistake, and that it has been the policy of the United States government in the last 5 years, especially, to introduce foreign Sunni Wahhabic extremists into Syria for the express purpose of overthrowing the legitimate government of that country led by President Assad. Mm-hmm. Do I think Assad is an angel? No. I don't think any political leader is an angel. I am simply saying that he is the president of that country. And what the United States is doing in that country politically and economically and militarily now and by both economic and black ops subversion is all illegal. There is no congressional declaration of war that has ever existed between this country and Syria. There is no relevant UN Security Council authorization for anything that the United States is doing there. And quite the contrary, when we look at Russia, we see that Putin's actions in Syria are not only in terms of the legitimate self-interest of its own country, but Vladimir Putin and Russia were invited into Syria by the legitimately constituted government of that country to defend against this illegitimate attempt by the United States and Israel, chiefly, and Saudi Arabia and its allies, secondarily, to overthrow his government. And that's where I think maybe we would speak with a little more clarity than Dr. Cohen in regard to who specifically is behind what is going on in Syria. I think the lion's share of this is Israel and Netanyahu and their overwhelming number of agents in the American media, in the American foreign policy, in national security establishments, and up on Capitol Hill, and the disproportionate influence of the Zionist lobbies in both the Republican and Democratic parties all play into this utterly irresponsible action on the part of the U.S. in Syria, which is just an extension of what we've been doing in the Middle East for years, especially in the last 25 years. But when it comes to this atrocious criminal action. And I will say I believe it to be a criminal action. These American airstrikes killed these 62 Syrian Arab Army soldiers who were trying to defend their own country from ISIS and Al-Qaeda. This should not be seen in isolation from the overall interventionism of the United States in foreign policy that took place in Libya, that took place in Iraq, that took place in Afghanistan. And now, of course, we're reading as of today about American drone attempts to infiltrate Iranian airspace, not only with unmanned aerial vehicles, but this latest incident, it is alleged that a U-2 spy plane was attempting to enter Iranian airspace. Mm-hmm. This sort of stuff we don't need to be doing. It's not only illegal, it's ill-advised. And certainly when you look at how we are upping the ante in the Ukraine and in Eastern Europe with the irresponsible deployments of NATO in Eastern Europe, what we said we would never do, we told the Russian leadership at the time of the demise of the Soviet Union that we would never take advantage of their situation after the Soviet Union went out of business. Those were assurances of Bush to Gorbachev. Mm-hmm. Every bit of that has proven to be a lie. We now have a situation, of course, there where we have recruited Eastern Bloc countries to join NATO. We keep deploying NATO and American military assets closer to Russian borders. But with what we're doing in the Baltic, certainly looks increasingly provocative. And then to read not only recently about this 31,000-man NATO military exercise in Poland, but the deployment of an American medium-range missile capability in Romania, these are not laughing matters. Mm-hmm. And so I think when we look at Syria and look at Ukraine and look at Eastern Europe, this is all a part of a seamless garment. And the point is that the stakes are being raised even as we speak. And if Clinton is elected president of the United States, if John Pilger and Robert Perry and Eric Margolis and Philip Giraldi are correct, we are probably well on our way to a much wider, much more horrible tragedy.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I do want to reference Cohen's interview one more time.
Sure.
So what he was saying was he believes the reason for the attack by the United States Air Force on the Syrian Arab Army, which is the
Army SAA, of the government.
Yeah.
The government army.
The government army, was in order to scuttle the ceasefire, that the ceasefire agreement, one of the terms of it, was after 7 days, if it's successful for 7 days, then the United States would join with the Russian military to bomb ISIS, to fight ISIS together with the Russian military, and that this is what the military, under Ash Carter, does not want to do. Now, Professor Cohen speculated that cooperation with Russia in Syria could lead to cooperation in the Ukraine and elsewhere and de-escalate the Cold War. And on this and other interviews, Cohen has speculated that in Obama's weakling way, he really does not want to be remembered as the president that kicked off a new and worse Cold War, but doesn't seem to have very good control over his own administration. But that there are people in the administration, he points out people like Biden and Ash Carter, but also Victoria Nuland, these people at the State Department, and especially the Washington Post and the New York Times. Now, he doesn't come out and say, you know, these Zionist or Jewish elements, but he names the names.
Right.
He names the names and leaves, he lays out the dots and leaves it for other people to connect.
Yes.
But that's who he's indicating. And he has also said that he thinks that these people at the State Department and some at the Defense Department, but, you know, he especially talks about the people in the State Department and the Washington Post and the New York Times and this establishment have what he has called a vendetta against Putin. Now, he doesn't say why they have a vendetta against Putin, but what I would say is that Putin came in 2000 at a time when Yeltsin's support was like in 1 or 2% across the country, that you had, in effect, a Jewish mafia that had taken over the country, had pillaged it, took control of all of the economic assets, became these oligarchs, these 15 or 20 oligarchs that controlled the economy, that owned everything, while meanwhile there was a demographic collapse among the Russian people, with the male life expectancy going from about 66 down to 58 or something like that, the birth rate plummeting, the population contracting, that Putin came and he put in prison some of the oligarchs, kicked out others, and then made a truce with the rest. Okay, you can keep your assets, but you stay out of politics. to me, what I would say is that the Zionist establishment or the Jewish tribalist establishment around the world, a big hunk of them have never forgiven him. And that's why people like Victoria Nuland or whoever else you want to throw in there have this vendetta against Putin. They want to overthrow Putin and are willing to risk World War III to do it. That's my assessment.
It's mine, too. And you've just added what, for understandable reasons, Dr. Stephen F. Cohen did not say in his interview on the John Batchelor Show. Your understanding, Patrick, of who is ultimately behind this coincides with my own. And just looking at Ukraine alone, Victoria Nuland. What we know about Victoria Nuland is the Undersecretary of State for European Affairs, who was picked up through a covert surveillance in a telephone conversation with the American ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt, at the time, talking about these American support for a coup d'etat in Kiev and how much money the United States government had been putting into this effort. And who it was that they wanted to become the next prime minister of the Ukraine. She named that individual by name. And have a situation where...
Arsen Yatsenyuk,
that's the name. Yes, Yatsenyuk. And, of course, he ultimately faded away. But the fact is that Victoria Nuland is married to Robert Kagan, one of the chief Jewish neoconservatives and one of the chief architects of the Project for the New American Century. That in 1996, as many of us remember, 5 years before 9/11 even happened, the Project for the New American Century was presenting a roadmap for ongoing destabilizations and destructions of Middle Eastern countries, with the express idea in mind, of course, that it would help Israel. It would help Israel's influence to expand in Palestine and in the Middle East generally. And that clearly this was this whole business of a vast improvement in the Zionist fortunes in that part of the world, using America as their surrogate political and military force to achieve these aims, that as a part of that whole package, it seems that for the reasons that you have just outlined with Vladimir Putin's trouble, with these oligarchs who are fleecing Russia blind after the end of the old Soviet Union, that they have targeted him. They have targeted Russia. And not simply because Putin, in their eyes, has had the audacity to support the Palestinian cause, which so many people around the world do. President Putin has been very forthcoming about the fact that there needs to be a legitimate, independent Palestinian state. Mm. The other thing is, of course, when we start looking at this issue of central banking, it's not really an accident that when the previous government in Kiev prior to the February of 2014 coup, when the previous government of Ukraine decided that they would conclude a major economic deal with Russia rather than the European Union, that was essentially what finally facilitated the decision to overthrow the Yanukovych regime in Kiev and to employ the most sordid elements to do it.
Yeah. If I could just interject for 1 second.
Sure.
So in that telephone call that you referenced that had been intercepted and where she was plotting the coup and naming her preferred leaders for after the coup, some people might recall that she had famously, when being informed that the EU was not quite on board with her plans, she famously said, F the EU. And could not deny it. She could not deny this. So we know this was a legitimate conversation. It was in her voice. She couldn't deny it. And in fact, as a joke, she made up I heart the EU buttons, you know, lapel buttons for her staff and underlings at the State Department. One of them showed me the button. So this is who we're talking about.
Yes, and that's exactly who we're talking about. And she is a part, as is Samantha Power. Steve Cohen referenced her in this conversation that he had with John Batchelor in the last couple of days. Samantha Power, the United States ambassador to the United Nations, is a warmonger. Mm-hmm. And I find it interesting that Dr. Cohen used that term, the same as I used that term when Power was concerned on
not
a previous
just a
appearance.
Warmonger, but he used some sort of superlative, the worst of the warmongers or something like that.
Yes. And Samantha Power is clearly, much like Victoria Nuland and all of these other key components in the usual cabal that is running our foreign policy, is a committed Zionist, is committed to the Bretton Woods central banking system, such as that has developed since the end of World War II. And of course, when the United States has found itself in situations where there were countries that understandably did not like what we were doing in their countries, those countries were subsequently subjected to economic sanctions, internal black ops, subversion from within, and in worst case scenarios, threats sometimes actualized to employ overt military force to achieve the cabal objective. Now, one of the striking things to me about the Cohen interview, when you listen to all 40 minutes of it, and he was just at this point, I believe, referencing Ukraine, he was talking about how unsustainable our policy is in Ukraine. That ever since the coup d'etat, February of 2014, American policy in Ukraine is starting to fall apart like a cheap suit. The Russians, of course, have taken over Crimea with the full support of the Crimean people, I might add. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to the Poroshenko regime in Kiev, that clearly is coming apart like a cheap suit, just as the Yatsenyuk, or whatever his name was, didn't last terribly long as prime minister. The point is that Ukraine is becoming a political and economic basket case and is becoming a liability for both the United States and the EU in terms of the Ukrainian exposure, or should we say the exposure of just like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to the economic situation in the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you start looking at all of this, it's quite obvious what's going on here and who's pulling the strings. But the long and the short of it is, I would at this point go beyond Dr. Cohen and say that the entire American foreign policy, as we have come to understand that in my lifetime, that has been hijacked by this neoconservative Zionist element, I think has made our foreign policy around the world unsustainable. Mm-hmm. And when you start looking at the destruction of massive amount of life in the Middle East, the destruction of infrastructure of countries, the American difficulty with pursuing an effective strategy of occupation and counterinsurgency warfare in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, the mess we're making of Syria, now risking a confrontation with a major military power that can actually fight. You know, you start looking at all of this, it's like, where is this going to end? And for me, it is obvious that Paul Craig Roberts, I think, pointed this out one time in an article. He said, you know, historically, empires go out of business with these kinds of policies because they run out of men and they run out of money. And that is the bottom line in all of this. I'm reminded of a quotation from Pat Buchanan's book, The Unnecessary War, where he analyzes both the First and Second World Wars and what really happened. Buchanan in that book quotes the British historian A.J.P. Taylor, who was observing about the so-called 30 Years' War of 1914 to 1945. Quote, though the object of being a great power is to be able to fight a great war, the only way of remaining a great power is not to fight one. And so when you look at this issue of war and who is forcing us into these wars and why and who it is that is playing around in terms of fiat money and war with our national currency and the situation with our economy, and the fact that by the 30th of this month, which will be the end of the fiscal year for 2016, we will have rung up something like a $19.3 trillion national debt. Clearly, the Victoria Nulands of the world, the Robert Kagans of the world, the Bill Kristols of the world, the Project of the New American Century people of the world, the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, and clearly in terms of the war party, the Zionist party and the banking party, their beloved candidate Hillary Clinton, this cannot continue. And at some point it is going to come to a dramatic and screeching halt, I argue a catastrophic halt, if it's not stopped in time. Mm-hmm. And again, Dr. Cohen is well taken in saying that our policy in Ukraine is unsustainable. But I argue that it's a part of a much larger picture in how we're doing business around the world, that in terms of our own survivability, much less that of the world, is also unsustainable. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And just a word on Samantha Powers. You know, she's, I believe, was born in Ireland. She's not Jewish, but she is married to Cass Sunstein, one of these Jewish professors from Harvard, Jewish law professor, one of the people who was in Elena Kagan's law department.
Yes.
And so it's not as if this war party is entirely Jewish, but I think there is a preponderance of Jewish
yes.
power in it and behind it. And there is a critical mass of Jewish power. And so you're having a Jewish agenda that's being followed. Cohen was interesting. He is, for over a year now, he has been pointing out that Donald Trump is the only person in American political life. Now, he's leaving out people like David Duke, but he's the only person who's in the political spotlight who is saying anything about getting along with Russia. And that he said that he's constantly receiving flack for saying that Donald Trump shows common sense. And, of course, he's stated that Hillary, not only is she part of this project that's leading us to destruction and this insane confrontation with Russia, but that her position is to double down on it. So she has a great deal of responsibility, having led the State Department for the first Obama term.
Yes.
Because this is when Libya happened. This is when the Syrian civil war started. She also has responsibility for bringing in Victoria Nuland, who had been Dick Cheney's foreign policy advisor. So imagine
yes.
Hillary Clinton coming in and then bringing in Dick Cheney's foreign policy advisor as the State Department spokesperson. So she has a great deal of responsibility for this, but now she wants to go beyond. And so I just desperately hope for a discussion of this at one of these upcoming debates, because this is the type of thing that could really wake up a lot of people who by default would vote for Hillary. Maybe they were Sanders supporters and they're just going to vote for Hillary. Maybe they're women who have some sort of vague identification with feminism and would vote for Hillary. But there's a lot of women who would like to see the first woman president, but would not want to vote for the first woman president and have that person then lead to a nuclear Armageddon.
Well, and you're talking about the very thing that I say to people who will talk to me both on and off the road on these subjects. Some of the members of the Democratic Party. I have many friends who are not conservatives, many people who certainly don't represent all of what I represent, either in part or in the whole, what I represent politically. I understand that, and yet we can still talk. And as we talk through things, I keep coming back and I keep pointing them to the John Pilgers of the world, the Robert Perrys of the world, the Eric Margolis and the Philip Giraldis and so forth, and I say to them, look, you don't have to agree with Mark Dankoff on social issues. You don't have to agree with Mark Dankoff about the best way of attempting to facilitate racial healing in the United States or whatever. But the fundamental core issue in this campaign, to me, from which everything else derives, war. Do we want a wider war in the Middle East and in Eastern Europe that could well become a third world war? That to me is the pivotal question in this election. And to me,
and it gets no attention.
What's that?
And gets no attention.
And it gets
it
no
is
attention.
A pivotal
you were
issue,
pointing
and it gets
this
no
out
attention.
On the Duke show on Rents yesterday. It's getting no attention. And it is the key issue. There are many fine key issues in this election. But the key issue is the issue of war and peace, and whether or not it is in the interest of the United States to facilitate ongoing interventionism in the Middle East, and now an absolutely confrontationalist policy with Vladimir Putin in Syria and in Ukraine and in Eastern Europe. And I will tell independent voters and Democrats who talk to me off the record about these things, I will simply say, hey, look, whatever you think of Donald Trump on issue 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6, or whatever you think of his personality or his professional history or his personal life in the past or whatever it happens to be, I don't see Trump as a messianic figure. I think like the rest of us, he has many flaws. We can talk about those fine. But do you want, I say to such folks, do you want either yourselves or your kids or your grandkids or your parents going into a third world war and perishing, an entirely avoidable third world war? Mm-hmm. Is that really what you want? And so we go back again to A.J.P. Taylor, analyzing the 30 years war of 1914 to 1945, quote, though the object of being a great power is to be able to fight a great war, the only way of remaining a great power is not to fight. And in that regard, when you look at people like Stephen F. Cohen, and when you look at some of the other people that are urging prudence in negotiation and diplomacy with Putin and Russia, emphasizing areas where there is commonality, and emphasizing areas where we can work together, and pulling us back from a situation that's now taking place in Eastern Europe and in Syria and in Ukraine that is not only avoidable, but largely, I argue, one of our own doing. One of our own doing. Russia, to the extent that it is clearly preparing itself to defend itself militarily if it has to, we've had what I argue, at least in my own mind, is largely a role reversal from what I used to think of the United States and Russia during the Cold War, or if you want to put a white hat and black hat on the participants in these things, I would say that at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and this is incredibly simplistic, but I do think there is something in it. Well, I think the majority of the people in the world in 1962, at the conclusion of the Cuban Missile Crisis, concluded that President Kennedy acted rationally, he acted diplomatically, he acted with great dispatch, and essentially in terms of achieving his objective, which was to get Russian missiles out of Cuba and to get them back to the Soviet Union and to have an international inspection to verify that and to avoid a third world war that would have become nuclear almost overnight, that most people would say that, hey, you know, this guy Kennedy, he's the good guy here. And if people were going to think in black and white terms, they would have seen the United States of the Kennedy period in the wake of what happened Cuba over the Cuban Missile Crisis. We came out of that looking very good.
Well, and one thing to add to that.
Nobody in the world believes that today about us.
No, one thing to add to that, one other thing that happened in the resolution of the Cuban Missile Crisis was Kennedy also agreed to take American nuclear-armed planes. Jupiter missiles out of Turkey. And
yes.
Most people don't know about that, but taking them out of Turkey also reduced tension.
That's right. And then, of course, he pledged not to invade Cuba. He said that there would no longer, as far as he was concerned, be any attempts on his part to destabilize Castro or to attempt to overthrow him or to invade Castro's Cuba. And, of course, there you have a combination, I argue, of military toughness on Kennedy's part, where he knew what he had to achieve, or we were going to have to go to war. But he used every type of front and back channel diplomacy to keep that conflict from happening. By God's grace alone, it didn't happen. But when we look today, and my late father, of course, was an Air Force intelligence officer in the Cold War for about a dozen years of that very fine and long career. And at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, my dad was involved in the Air Force organization, helping the CIA to run those U-2 spy planes. You know, my brother said to my dad years later, talking about the utter irresponsibility, as he saw it, of the Bush-Cheney foreign policy, Bush-Cheney-Rumsfeld actions. Dad said, if we go back to 1962 and George W. Bush is president, would he have just gone along with the Joint Chiefs? Would he have just done what they wanted done? Of course, the argument was, on my brother's part, that that's exactly what would have happened, and none of us would be here, quote-unquote. Mm. My dad had a hard time disputing that, although he had voted for George W. Bush a couple of times in presidential races. I didn't. I voted for third-party candidates, but my dad voted for Bush and also voted for his father a couple of times. But again, we start talking about people like Hillary Clinton in the White House, or people like Victoria Nuland,
who would
and
very likely
Kagan.
Be a Secretary of State in the Clinton administration.
Yeah, can you imagine if we faced something like what Kennedy was facing and the country was facing in October of 1962, what the outcome of that would be? And to me, the most disturbing aspect of this is that for people who are urging some degree of prudence and caution and plain sanity and common sense in all of this, they're being accused of being quote-unquote Putiners, or they're being accused of being appeasers or pacifists or afraid to flex American muscle around the world. I would argue, where has the flexing of this muscle just in the last 25 years alone really gotten us? Trillions of dollars in debt with all of this borrowed and spent money, thousands upon thousands, the total by now might even be millions of lives that have been ended or ruined by these interventions. We are no closer to any kind of responsible political resolution in any of these areas of the world that we have intervened in. in the last 25 years. And now we are talking about moving from this phase of intervening in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya. Wrong as I think those interventions mm-hmm. have been. Mm-hmm. We're now talking about picking a fight with a country that's a nuclear power, that has a solid, resolute, intelligent president, and that has a very proud history and will fight to defend what it perceives as its basic interests if its back is pushed to the wall. Do we really think that the Russians are going to continue just in perpetuity to put up with coup d'etats like the one we pulled off in the Ukraine? Mm-hmm. Do we really think that they are going to continue to put up with these actions like these illegal, immoral American Air Force strikes against the Syrian Arab Army the other day? Do we really think that as we get closer and closer to their borders and with NATO and with American missiles and troops, that they are just going to sit back in perpetuity and not take countermeasures to make sure that if necessary, they fight? My reading, I'm no Russian historical expert, as Stephen Cohen is, but it certainly seems to me, with my own meager understanding of Russia and of the history of that country, the way I read the Russian mind, the way I read the mind of their current president, these are people to be taken very seriously. And these notions of American and Israeli exceptionalism, somehow it seems linked in the minds of people like Elliot Abrams, mm-hmm. the continued pursuit of that kind of legacy, which is totally at odds with our historic founding fathers' foreign policy, is going to destroy us mm-hmm. as a nation, even as it takes down thousands of millions of other people around the world who are going to be the victims of all of what is going to continue happening if we don't get this stopped.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is, I think, the key issue of the campaign.
I think you're so right. And, you know, one of the crazy things about this project to regime change Russia, this dream of Victoria Nuland and her various Zionist backers, is that if you remove Putin, then what? They just had a parliamentary elections in Russia a few days ago, and the so-called pro-Western parties weren't even on the map. None of them are going to be represented in the new parliament. They have almost no support.
And Cohen referenced that development and what happened.
And to the extent that in the Russian political class, there's people who are questioning Putin's leadership, it's people who think that Putin is being too conciliatory to the United States. If you were to undermine Putin, the people who are going to take over are people who have a much, I'm not going to say paranoid, because I think there's actually some basis in their feeling, who have a much more hostile view of the United States.
That's exactly right. Classic example of this, and because I am not a Russian expert, quote unquote, it was only in recent years that I learned who this man is, a General Igor Strelkov, who had been a Russian general serving in the Ukrainian theater, as I remember. Strelkov is emerging as a major force mm-hmm. with what appears to be a strong element in the Russian political scene to President Putin's right. And it's clear that this guy, Strelkov, has a lot of support in the Russian military. He's a hardline Russian nationalist. He's got these YouTube videos. I found out through the American Conservative, they ran an article on him quite a long time ago, who the guy was and is, I started occasionally checking up on the guy through YouTube, where they have some of his press conferences and so forth on there with subtitles. This is a type of thinking in a worldview that if something happens to President Putin, if he is destabilized, and I pray that that doesn't happen, but if it does, you've just nailed it as far as I'm concerned. And I think Stephen F. Cohen, with what he did say on his show with John Batchelor a couple of days ago, I think he would probably say this as well, that you inevitably would be quite likely to get a much more militaristic, quote-unquote, right-wing, anti-Western Russian figure installed in the Russian presidency, and that the most hardline elements of the Russian military would presumably have a Strelkov-like orientation and would rise to the fore to say, hey, look, we tried this diplomacy stuff. They've kept pushing the envelope. It's apparent to us we're going to have to fight these people. So let's just get ready and recognize that from here on out, we don't cooperate with them in any way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. And anytime we get some diplomatic approach from them that's obvious window dressing, we just blow it off. And since they have demonstrated no goodwill in any of this up to this point and have been lying to us repeatedly in regard to Eastern Europe and NATO, Syria and Ukraine and all the rest of it, this is it. We're not going to cooperate with these people anymore. And if they really want to have a conflict with us, then we need to plan the time and the place where that conflict is going to happen and be prepared to fight it out. I think that's the likely outcome.
Wow. Okay, so we're nearing the end. Is there anything else that you want to bring up, whether it's about Russia or anything else?
Well, I referenced on Duke's show on Rents a day or so ago this Pat Buchanan article, Threats of One's Own Making, the Killing of the West. In terms of how these wars happen and why, Buchanan cites four people, Ernest Hemingway, A.J.P. Taylor, Vladimir Lenin, and John Adams. That's well worth taking a look at. I believe that is probably online. Mm-hmm. I would point out to people some of the latest things going on with George Soros and his new 7-point program for reforming the immigration and migration policies of the Western countries. And I think most people will see through that agenda when they read Soros's public statements on that subject. Take a look at South Front and Russia Insider in regard to their excellent videos online on YouTube in regard to these latest incidents in Syria. And then, of course, the whole issue of Israel national news. And just very recently in the last week, they were saying that the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith has just hired a new technical director to monitor, quote-unquote, anti-Semitism on the Internet and to counteract it.
Oh, my God.
And so that's well worth keeping an eye on because it's clear that Israel and the Israeli lobby in the United States have recognized that the advent, serious advent of alternative media and international Internet communications and social media, that they're losing the war for public minds around the world. And clearly this indicates a more aggressive approach on their part to continue their Hasbara project to vilify anyone who speaks out against what they're doing. Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a young person just yesterday point out to me that YouTube has just announced that they will initiate this new program. I think they call it Yahoo Heroes. And the heroes can earn money by flagging inappropriate content. And their video announcing this new program says, and you can do it by mass flagging content. Mass flagging content. And apparently there's something of an uproar that the thumbs down for this video outweigh the thumbs up by a factor of something like 40-1. But talk about professionalizing the Hasbara industry or censorship. You're paying people out there to censor what happens on YouTube. And, you know, we had Colin Flaherty's YouTube channel got banned a few weeks ago. He has a new one. And Dr. Duke last year had faced a possible banning and had some of his videos removed. But, yeah, it's very scary what's going on there.
It's absolute Stalinism, as far as I'm concerned. And it's very, very clear. I do not have as much visibility as Dr. Duke does. And yet I have had enough visibility in recent years that even at my level of things, I can tell you that the things that these folks are capable of are not only a violation of decency and ethics when it comes to responsible political discourse and treating people as charitably as possible, but the implications of this for the First Amendment of the United States Constitution are obvious. And again, when we start looking at the number of people, the best people, I'm not talking a lot of idiots out there, the best people in alternative media who are doing what we're doing in these alternative media radio outlets and appearing on these international shows and so forth. That says everything that one needs to understand about the absolute iron-fisted control that the War Party and the Zionist Party and the Bankers Party has of the six major media consortiums in this country that control electronically and in print what most Americans are exposed to, unless they're using alternative media. Mm-hmm. And they don't like the fact that as alternative media has flourished and more people have an opportunity to be exposed to foreign news coverage and alternative foreign coverage around the world of different events, they can't spin things with quite the effectiveness that they once did. Mm-hmm. So their reaction to this clearly is to attempt to stamp it out and to make free speech illegal and to false tag as hate speech those who simply responsibly, vociferously oppose what their global agenda is and who oppose what their obvious domestic agenda is in the United States.
Hello, I'm Mr. Red.
Well, Mark Dankoff, we want to do whatever we can to raise your visibility because you are such a clear thinker and a clear speaker. It's vital people hear your voice. Thank you so much for coming back on the show, and I look forward to you joining us again.
Thanks, Chief.
Thank you. Until next time, when we'll have another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio, this is your host, Patrick Slattery, and keep thinking clearly. Hey, stop the music! Stop the music! What was that anyway? Well, after signing off, Reverend Dankoff and I continued the conversation a little bit, and some of it was pretty interesting, and I think I'm going to splice that in as an added bonus. Take a listen. But one thing we do know is we are being monitored, and often we're being quoted on CNN or the New York Times or whatever. Hillary quoted a show a few weeks ago when she did her alt-right speech. I certainly hope that Trump is listening because he needs a lot of help with his narrative. I get really discouraged sometimes because Trump, he doesn't speak clearly, but he does speak with common sense most of the time. But his surrogates have Rudy Giuliani come out and try to be a surrogate on Vladimir Putin or what's going on in Syria. It doesn't work. Because Giuliani's a neocon himself.
Yes, absolutely.
And his other surrogates, just like the guy I see on CNN a lot is some guy, what's his name? Jeffrey Lord. He doesn't think clearly. He just, it's kind of maybe like 15-year-old Fox News talking points. That's kind of his level. And so that's the one thing that really worries me about his campaign is that a lot of the message doesn't come out clearly because he doesn't enunciate things clearly, even though I think he thinks pretty clearly. But
yes,
he doesn't enunciate them clearly, and then his surrogates are losers. And, of course, if he gets elected, who's he going to appoint to his administration? There's nobody out there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And to me, some of the people that he's consulting in the foreign policy arena are not good. Mm. And, again, I've all along maintained that supporting him is a calculated risk. We have to, because the alternative is unthinkable. And yet, with some of the very real concerns that you're pointing out here, I have shared those concerns from the beginning in regard to Trump. And, you know, I don't think that Trump is Pat Buchanan. Mm-hmm. I think Buchanan was far clearer and far more articulate in foreign policy as well as in the way that he articulated on the trade and immigration issues than Trump. Buchanan also talked about cultural issues in a far deeper way than Trump does, and I understand that. But to me, if you had a Buchanan administration, I would be reliably assured that we would be getting foreign policy advisors, for example. I don't know where he would be getting them, but they would be people that would basically not be from this neoconservative element, the Zionist element. With Trump and his whole history of the intermarriage in his family, his longtime Jewish business connections. He was once, as you know, a grand marshal at an Israel Day parade in New York. I have a lot of concerns about it with somebody like John Woolsey hanging around in the Trump effort. I'm nervous about
this. Well, with Buchanan, even though he wasn't a politician for most of his career, he was a journalist, but he was working in the field. So he would have been able to identify and bring in better people to an administration. Trump, being a complete outsider, he's coming in and he's just looking around the establishment. He doesn't have this network of people that he's
been working
with.
He doesn't have the political savvy and experience that Buchanan did.
Now, the one thing that does make me hopeful is I can't see Trump being like Obama, where I think Obama actually has some decent instincts about certain things, but is such a complete weakling that maybe he gets Kerry to negotiate a ceasefire and then he's unwilling to enforce it on his own administration. And I can't see Trump doing that. I think Trump has made better relations with Russia important enough of an issue that I can't see him just letting his Russia policy be undermined by underlings. But there is a concern that, well, who's he going to bring in to implement it? That's a concern.
Yes. So we shall see what we shall see. But clearly, if Clinton is elected, we know if she wins this election, but I don't see how this country, with the direction we've been going in, both internationally and domestically, how we survive this.
Yeah.
If she wins.
Okay.
I really don't.
Okay, and that's the real end of the show. I hope it was interesting for everybody. And be sure to join us next time for another interesting episode of National Bugle Radio. This is Patrick Slattery. Aloha.